This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Becky Yang Su, a sociologist from Georgetown University. Becky recently published a new book with Cambridge University Press, Borrowing Together, Microfinance and Cultivating Social Ties. It's a real treat to have her join us today. Welcome, Becky.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Becky, tell us about Borrowing Together.
Okay, it is kind of a ridiculously simple argument. Basically, I'm arguing that concepts of personhood, so what you think a person is or what you imagine a person is, will come out in the theories about people, so about social theory. And I'm kind of finding, or I look at a specific set of theories about microfinance that economists have. And then I see how they play out in an actual field site. So I studied rural China and then looked at how much or whether the expectations of people actually happened there. And yeah, not to spoil it, but they didn't happen.
Well, how are they different? In what way do you feel like let's say established views are wrong?
Okay. I mean, so we're all from Princeton. And I think one of the things that I guess I learned at Princeton was to bash on economists. And so that's kind of what I do in the book. You can edit this out if you want. But basically, you know, it's like the typical stuff. But I mean, I guess, well, first, I was thinking actually about the title that I chose for the book, and I may kind of regret it, and this maybe should be edited out. Anyway, sorry. But I realized that in our cultural context in the United States, a title like Borrowing Together sounds like it's already a positive spin on it. I mean, anything that sounds together is like, oh, that must be good, because the converse of it is that not together is the sort of the expectation. Mm-hmm. And then if it's together, it's like a surprise. And then it's like, oh, it must be good. But that's not the way other people in the world live, I guess. And the individualistic expectations of how people would behave don't play out there. So I guess you're asking what doesn't happen, yeah. I guess. Yeah. So the first thing is that in microfinance, they put people into groups. And they go, oh, now that you're in groups, you can pressure each other to repay the loans. And then that way, everybody will repay the loans. And then you guys can all get new loans. And then you're going to like make a profit or make a business with mm-hmm. your loan. And then you're going to work, you know, get out of mm-hmm. poverty. So this is the thing. First, there's the assumption of it's the assumption of a blank slate. What I found in my field site was that you put people in groups, but they're already in groups.
Exactly.
I mean, the assumption that it's like, oh, we're going to put you in groups and then you're going to do stuff together. Like that right away is like not taking into account the reality that people are already very social and already have their groups. So that was the first thing. and it's something that James Ferguson, who's an anthropologist, I think now he's at Stanford, talked about like way back in one of the classics on global development, which is this thing that people think that there's this blank slate. Like you go to a third world country or a developing country and then it's like, oh, let me fix you. And then you can, the assumptions that like there's nothing there to begin with.
How were these Chinese micro lenders? How was their social life or community life different from what we in the West might expect? Those of us who've been thinking about microfinance before.
Okay. Well, first, I guess one of the premises with the economic theories is that people have to be put into a position where they are incentivized to repay loans, and otherwise they won't repay the loans, right? That's kind of the whole point of like they set up these incentive structures and you're supposed to pressure each other. But I found like when I was asking about, I looked at two different programs, and when I was asking about one of them, I was asking about loans in general in the community. And I was like, well, so, you know, when's the last time somebody didn't repay a loan to somebody else? And they're like, what are you talking about? Because it was such a crazy thing to not repay a loan to somebody else in the village. And if you think about it, that completely makes sense. Everybody's been there for generations. People have, you know, like the, you'd live next to your uncle who's watched you grow up, you know, or your neighbor who's watched you grow up or whatever. And they know your mom and your aunt and your best friend. And for you to not repay somebody a loan in the village, that just makes no sense. So even have it, like the idea of like, we have to put you in some kind of incentive structure to make you repay the loan. That just didn't even make sense in this context.
Do you feel like microloans are having a positive impact on Chinese development, or do you think they're more of a non-factor?
They're kind of a non-factor. Yeah. I mean, so basically I looked at two different programs. One of them didn't work too well. One of them, people didn't repay the loans. Or half of them didn't. The other one, everybody did because of the way it was structured. But neither of them actually led to much well-being. I mean, you know, the idea that like, oh, you get like $100 and then you're supposed to create a little business. And then like you create the business, but who are you going to sell your stuff to? Oh, the other people in the village. Oh, like where's that money coming from, right? So it's a little bit, doesn't work.
Becky, what you were talking about a minute ago with like the blank slate and kind of coming in and, oh, we'll fix you. It reminds me a little bit of kind of an underlooked aspect of imperialism. If you think back to kind of the Victorian age of it, where a lot of it really was altruistic in motive, right? We think of imperialism in terms of like, you know, basically militaries coming in and then resource extraction. But there was a whole aspect of it where you had this wave of kind of ecumenical Protestantism coming in with missionaries who were effectively the Victorian equivalent to NGOs trying to, you know, basically remake people in, you know, with entirely altruistic motives, and not just for their eternal souls, but for their lives on earth.
Yeah,
it was a white man's burden.
Well, no, white man's burden, it was... a specific reference from Kipling to American involvement in the Philippines. And that really was about kind of military occupation and force of arms to come in and, you know, civilize the savage races, that sort of thing. But I'm talking more about the Victorian equivalent to NGOs, where there's no violence at all.
Yeah, sorry. Michael Barnett is a historian who he has a book on the history of humanitarianism, and he calls, I think, what you're talking about the civilizational motive or something like that. Mm-hmm. But basically, it's, you know, they're really altruistic. I mean, they want to help people, and they have the idea to like make them into better people by civilizing them. Mm-hmm. Oof! Yikes! Is that right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I was partly thinking about like Neil Ferguson's imperialism book that came out like 15 years ago, you know, where he talked about there's the military aspect, the economic aspect, but there was also this very strong kind of proto NGO aspect from ecumenical Protestant missionaries.
Yeah. So my comment, Becky, has to do with the title of your book, which I actually love. Right. So, right. Like the title of your book to me, like evokes Bowling Alone. Right. Which I think is great. And it's like barring together. So, you know, love them or not. Right. You know, Bowling Alone, like was huge, 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 huge. Right. And, you know, with this idea that like, oh my goodness, like our social ties are eroding. And because of this, you know, civilization is going down the toilet. Right. But what he's talking about are very, very specific types and forms of social capital. Right. And I think that that's part of what you're doing is you're leveling this critique, right, against this idea that there are these very, very specific types of social capital, number one, that you build on, and also sort of forms of social networks that help to ensure that like trust, you know, is built. And so people will repay their loans. And so in that respect, I mean, I actually love your title.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think you're right that this turned out to be a critique of social capital work. And I didn't mean it that way, but it was a little bit in my backdrop, kind of the backdrop of what I was doing. So what I don't like about social capital theory is that it's looking at social relationships as a means to other ends. And, you know, whether it be economic development or political something, something, or, you know, individual, even individual sort of happiness, you know, satisfaction or something. But that's not the only way to look at it. So for some people, the social relationships are the end and the other things are a means to them. So actually, what I found in the field site was that in one of the programs that I was looking at, people were using the microfinance loans like in a wily way, I guess, but they used it to curry favor to the people that they wanted to have better relationships with. Some of that was, I mean, relationship sounds sort of nicer than, you know, than it was. Sometimes it was instrumental relationships, sometimes it was otherwise, I guess. But anyway, people were actually using the money to curry favor with people who had power, either socially or politically.
Yeah, I'm just thinking like it's such like a great example of like you have these like, you know, microfinance, social entrepreneur, blah, 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 coming in and saying like, well, it's, you know, established credit associations. And then what do people do with it? They use it for guanxi. You know, it's like, you know, the thing of like the plan doesn't survive contact. You know, on the ground, it just doesn't work out the way people hope it would when they're giving their TED talk.
So, Becky, more deeply, so your book seems to talk a lot about trust and, you know, the more cultural dimensions of social ties. Were there any parts of that experience where you felt you gained some insight that could help you make sense of what's, you know, life in America at all?
Well, I think for me, actually, what it showed me was the bias of a lot of social science. So, you know, assuming that people are individualistic, assuming that the ends are not social relationships, assuming that people use social relationships to get money as opposed to using money to get social relationships. This is, I mean, I, you know, so I critique, like, I critique Joseph Stiglitz. I'm not afraid to, reach for the, he knows he won't know anything about me, but you know, I might as well, I could say whatever I want. Right. But yeah, I mean, I guess I think there's a lot of social science and it's not just economics, but a lot of other work in a lot of social science, the social sciences, I should say, that have these very culturally specific assumptions about how people work.
Yes. No, Becky, and that totally goes back to my comment about Wakanda at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so I started reading what is called post-colonial theory, which I didn't realize existed until after I pretty much finished this book.
It's always the way.
But once I started reading, Julian Goh at Boston University has a book out. I think it's just called Postcolonial Theory. But basically, he's talking about the way that sociology has been super provincial. I mean, the assumptions, the way that the history of it has come from a very specific place and does not take into account the way that a lot of people in the world, maybe a majority of them, actually live. That's something that that's exactly, I think, what I show, I think, in my book.
But do you think we're really all that different? I mean, how many colleagues do you know reduce everything to power instead of material gain, right? Like, there are a lot of people who have sort of one central organizing concept in their worldview, and they just see it everywhere, right? Maybe it's material gain or efficiency or whatever for an economist. But do you think we're qualitatively different as sociologists if we see just everything's power or...
Yeah, no, I actually think sociologists are really provincial too, unfortunately.
In what way?
Yeah, I mean, everything's about equality or inequality. And actually, I think there are actually other ways to look at social relationships. It's not just about distribution of power, distribution of, you know, benefits or equality the way that we we tend to focus on.
Can you tell us a little bit about the challenges of doing field work in rural China? Like, what was that like? Like, what advice would you give someone who's thinking about running a study that goes into the same type of site?
Okay, there are definitely challenges. And actually, fun fact, I was out there, I think it was the last year or second to last year I was out there. It was also the high point of the avian flu. And so I was out there, I had gotten the kind of warning from whatever health travel people. And I was having lunch or dinner. I think it was lunch because it was daylight. And someone came by and just, they had like a bowl of chicken blood that had just been sitting outside for a while. Like when we came in, I saw it sitting outside. And then while we were eating, somebody came in and we were all sharing this big kind of hot pot, mm-hmm. like kind of a big pot, and everybody's taking from it and it's, you know, mm-hmm. kind of like boiling. Mm-hmm. Someone picked up that bowl and poured the whole thing into the hot pot. So this is chicken blood during the height of avian flu. So I was, I kind of stopped eating after that.
Wait, I hope it was someone you were eating with. It wasn't just a passerby, right?
It was the cook. I mean,
Becky, you're definitely not going to be the next Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't eat it.
No,
but
he would eat it. I think.
Oh, he would. At the height of avian flu,
I think so.
Well, wait a minute. Was the hot pot at an actual boil or not, right? Because, you know, you get up to 165 degrees for 10 minutes, whatever, you'll be fine.
Well, then it cleans out the blood? Dude, I'm not eating.
Well, if it would kill a virus or something.
It probably would. I think they were all okay.
Yeah.
You know, and that you're right. I kind of chickened out that day because most of the time.
No pun intended.
So fieldwork definitely had its challenges. I lived with NGO staff and some sort of small town government officials. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I think it would be hard for many, maybe some people. But I don't know. On the other hand, it's every day was really exciting and, you know, there's always stuff to learn and stuff. In terms of what I would tell somebody who's going out there, actually, the environment in China right now for doing research is it's things are tightening up. You've probably seen stuff in the news about President Xi, kind of consolidating power, yeah. And it's sort of in the air. I mean, researchers are very careful. Now I think more than they were before. Maybe just 3 or 4 years ago, it was fine. It was more fine to go out and kind of just look around and stuff. But at this point, I would, it's not easy right now.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.